Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Bald Move Prestige movie. Today, we're talking about 1988's Rain Man, who, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, this was like the top grossing film of the year and also did quite well for itself in the Oscars.
Yeah. It was nominated for 8, won 3, and it made like a billion times its budget.
Not bad. Not bad. It was directed by Barry Levinson, which you might recognize from his work on The Natural, Good Morning Vietnam, Wag the Dog, and Sleepers. It was written by Barry Morrow and Ronald Bass, or maybe Ronald Bass. I didn't look that up. Shoot, just realized. Which we'll talk about. We'll talk a little bit more about Barry Morrow when we start talking about the impact of the film it had on its subject matter. It stars, of course, Dustin Hoffman as Raymond Ray Babbitt. And it stars Tom Cruise as his brother Charlie, and also Valeria Golino, who I'd only known as the hot funny girl from Hot Shots, and Hot Shots Part Deux.
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen those that I didn't remember her from them. She's actually Italian, and she's playing Italian in this movie. So,
gotcha. And I wondered if like what happened to her, because she was in these big movies in the 80s, and I looked through her IMDb and some act, and I guess she is just one thing after another, man. She kept trying to work on both sides of the pond, and one contract would interfere with another contract, and then that would fall through, and then that was delayed, and she like that it seemed like 10 years of her life clicked by, and so it's a shame.
She's in a lot of big movies, like this.
Right.
So, I'm not saying this was a big movie, but she went to Rain Man right after Big Top Pee Wee, which, you know, not the best Pee Wee movie. But she's in, like you said, Hot Shots. She was in Leaving Las Vegas. She was in Escape from LA. Like,
she was in Leaving Las Vegas,
apparently playing someone named Terry. Yeah.
Jesus, we just saw that movie, and I did not remember.
It must have been a minor role. Yeah.
But yeah, what did you think? I mean, so let's talk about. I got a lot to unpack about this particular movie myself, but like, what did you think of this movie? What's your relationship with it since it's a kind of a classic, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I saw it. It's been over a decade since I've seen this movie. I definitely didn't see it even close to when it aired in the theaters, but I had seen it one time, and I remember thinking it was really good. And coming back to it now, I still think it's good. I don't think it's as good. I think the screenplay is not what is amazing here. I think the performances are what is amazing. The screenplay is sort of, it leaves me wanting something a little bit more from this movie. From Charlie, mostly. Like, I want something else here to really... I don't know, it kicked this movie into high gear somewhere in like the beginning of the third act, other than going to Vegas. But yeah,
Vegas wasn't the third act kicked into pants. Like,
I don't know. And maybe it's because I've seen this before and I know that Vegas is coming and I know that he's, you know, going to try and exploit Raymond in all these ways. But like, yeah, I think Dustin Hoffman's performance is incredible here. Tom Cruise is almost as good, even though he, you know, gets less praise for the role because it's not really as hard of a thing to play an asshole. We've seen a lot of people play assholes in movies, self-absorbed, you know, financially motivated douches. But yeah, I still think it's good. But the performances are what make it for me.
So this is the first time I've seen this movie myself. You know, it's one of those things in the 80s is rated R. I didn't get a chance to see it. And then, like, it's also when I was watching this, it felt very much like the experience I've had when I've watched a movie, but it's been a long time, because I felt like I've seen a vast majority of this movie. This movie was huge. I mean, we talked about it being a big box office draw. We talked about it being, making a lot of noise in the Oscars for the performances, like, you know, the Rain Man, the central Raymond role with Dustin Hoffman is very iconic. And like, I've seen so much of this movie parodied, quoted, referred to in commercials, that things like, you know, the card counting scene, the 2 minutes of Wapner stuff, like some of the affectations that Hoffman's character plays, all that stuff felt like it was kind of like review material. Which left kind of like the basic structure, like, as I didn't know, like, you know, some of these films, we were just talking about this when we were selecting Rain Man, because like right around the same time Rain Man came out, Philadelphia, you know. At the time, that was seen as a really big pro, I don't know, is pro gay the right term to say, or maybe like anti being a hateful bigot towards people with HIV AIDS
sure
is better. But like modern audiences, when they watch this, it's just like really hard to connect with Denzel Washington's character because he starts the movie as such a hateful bigot. But that is the world that the movie was made in. And I think that Rain Man is complicated the same way, that like before this movie, there weren't sympathetic portrayals of people with autism or any kind of like mental illness. And a lot of Tom Cruise's early attitudes towards his brother are painful, honestly, to watch, and especially painful because I know you know, I've had the same experience. Like, we grew up with a kid that was, I still to this day don't know exactly what his diagnosis was. I'm not sure if he got diagnosis, but he was what you would call, you know, had several cognitive impairments, emotional disabilities, and he could be a lot to deal with a lot of times. But he also was a really interesting, creative individual that brought a lot of joy into my life. And nowadays I have an autistic nephew that's 17 years old, and you know, he's not like profoundly autistic or like deep on the spectrum, but like, anyone spends a couple minutes talking to him is going to come away like, this guy's thinking a bit differently. So I was like, as I was watching this, I was like, huh, I wonder, you know, like what this movie's reputation is amongst like modern autism organizations and people that have autism and stuff. And as you would expect, it's kind of mixed, but it's more positive than I would have guessed. And I guess I kind of have all that stuff in my notes to talk about at the end of the movie. But there is a lot of this that I felt kind of like identified in, like from experiences I had in my own life, you know, with our friend. Experiences I've had with like my nephew, like that came out and kind of brought a smile to my face. But also there's a couple winces there because Tom Cruise is a super huge asshole and is not very patient and does not have a lot of time for accommodating his brother's disability at the beginning of the film. And I thought the end was very unsatisfying,
right?
But probably in a way that contemporaneously was meant to be. Like, you want the big happy holiday Hollywood ending where Tom Cruise comes to an appreciation of his brother and he gets to bring him into his life and his brother's world gets to expand beyond the institution that he's stuck in at the end of the film. But that doesn't happen. And then the film kind of ends in this kind of melancholy contemplation of that. And I think it's intentional.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how else do you see that going? Like, I mean, clearly Raymond needs 24/7 attention. Right. And Tom Cruise, Charlie, is not going to be able to give him that. It's just not going to happen. Right. He needs to be somewhere where people can attend to his needs 24 hours of the day. So it was only ever going to end that way. Right. I think the thing that is interesting about this movie is sort of the way that Charlie perceives Raymond through the course of the film, and the way he interacts with him, because like Charlie starts off as this self-absorbed asshole who's trying to manipulate everything around him to work out for his own ends. You know, this car scheme literally he's got going. Yeah. I mean, he's lying to people. He's changing people's minds. He's bribing people, whatever he needs to do. And he tries that shit with Raymond over the course of the movie, right? He's like, just why don't you just do this? Like, he's telling him all these things to do. He's telling him what not to do. Raymond doesn't give a shit, right? Raymond's the unmovable force, and here Tom Cruise is trying to be this, or he's the immovable object. Tom Cruise is trying to be the unstoppable force. It's just not working. So like over the course of the movie, his way of dealing, not just with Raymond, but probably with people in general, has to change because the other is not possible, right? Changing the things around him is no longer an option. So that's like probably the best part of this movie. I think it's the best thing this movie does is show that, depict that change in that character. But yeah, I felt definitely unsatisfied at the end of this movie, but probably intentionally, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, there's a glimmer of hope where he says goodbye to his brother, says, I'll see you in two weeks. So it's like, you know, obviously the middle route there, if Charlie can find in his heart, is to maybe move to Cincinnati or maybe find him a center in LA so that he can be a much bigger part of his brother's life, sure. You know, take him out on field trips. Cause I think I definitely got the opinion watching this movie that the institution where people, you know, it was a positive depiction. It wasn't like a hit piece mm-hmm. on a state run institution. They cared for him. He had meaningful friendships there, people he trusted, but yeah. like maybe they erred on the caution of like not triggering Raymond too much, like not exposing him to new things, not maybe. And yeah. there's a question of, and honestly, I'm as an amateur at all this, I'm not sure, but like the question of like, you know, could he have a bigger, more fulfilling, larger life? You know,
right? Could he tell could a joke? Could he, you know, kiss exactly. a girl, like that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. And a lot of this, like, you know, a lot of things I found in my research with this is that, you know, Barry Morrow had his life impacted by a few people severely, you know, that had these kind of profound mental and cognitive emotional impairments, but also may or may not have had gifts to kind of offset those. And he made stories about them. One was Bill Sactor, which is an autistic savant that got made into a TV film called Bill. And then Kim Peake, who inspired Rain Man, he actually turned that to his information about him and relationship into with him into the script for Rain Man. You know, when he won the Oscar, I thought this was an interesting thing. So what I'm getting at is Barry Morrow is like, seems like he's a very sympathetic person still to this day, involved in a lot of autistic and mental impairment organizations, gave his Oscar to Kim Peake, this autistic man who carried it with him everywhere, loves showing it to people, is called the most loved Oscar statue in the world because that's his favorite thing to do, is run up to people, show him the Oscar, let them hold it. And when he died in 2009, Morrow donated this to his hometown of Salt Lake City, for them to display permanently in a museum. And he set up a foundation and a charitable scholarship in Kim Peake's name. So it's like, this isn't like however you feel about it 32 years, 34 years later, this wasn't a film that was intended to exploit people. And it wasn't a film that was intended to exploit the subject matter. In fact, yeah. Everything I read said that this was a very positive thing in Kim Peake's life, and from a broadening his life, giving him more confidence, putting him in more contact with people. So like, yeah, like the idea that this was like some kind of malicious or like tone deaf or something made from someone outside of the community looking in, I think you could probably dismiss that. But, you know, like I said, I only spent like a bit of a morning researching that. So there's people with hot takes in these autism organizations that disagree, probably listen to them instead of me. But I did enjoy it, though. I thought mm-hmm. it was very funny in places.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Cruise's frustration with the situation, I felt very, I identified with that very strongly in a couple places. And personally, super flattered that Cincinnati was such a huge part that they bothered to actually come out to Cincinnati and film some of her famous landmarks and eat in some of her famous eateries and stuff.
Mostly
like
just
that.
Just bridges, right? I feel like those are the most identifiable landmarks from Cincinnati.
A lot of Roebling Suspension Bridge, which if you don't know, is essentially a scale model of the Brooklyn Bridge. Yeah. It was the thing that Roebling did before he designed the Brooklyn Bridge as kind of like a trial run, and Cincinnati got... We got the trial bridge. We're really Weak. Proud of it. but yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm glad I saw it, and had a really fond time. God, I'm really struggling finding my words today. I don't know. So yeah, what do you want to? We should maybe if you're like me and you haven't seen this movie before, I'll just briefly give you a rundown of what it's about, and you can make a decision and wait whether you want to see it or not, and then we'll talk in detail. Rain Man's about, as Jim said, this man Charlie. Tom Cruise is a real go-getter. He's it reminded me a lot of like the early goings of Wolf of Wall Street, yeah. where you had that guy just like trying to talk people into penny stocks. He's got this scheme where he's importing gray market Lamborghinis, trying to hustle them through customs because there's a shortage of these things and they're in high demand, and trying to get them to finesse them through EPA restrictions and all that kind of stuff. In the middle of this big deal where he's got like, I think $90,000 of his own money hung out on the line, he gets a call that his dad, who's been estranged from, has died. and left. There's a considerable estate to be settled. So he flies back to his hometown of Cincinnati, finds out that he was given rose bushes and an old car, mm-hmm. and the $3 million inheritance went to this blind, this distrust. And through some sleuthing, he figures out that this is essentially, I think, his half brother, that his dad that was never part of his life for mysterious reasons that he never knew he had. And now he knows he's got this brother and he's got this profound impairment and he's in an institution and he wants his share of the money. His dad explicitly wrote him into list. So he essentially kidnaps Raymond, his brother. Mm-hmm. And goes on a long road trip, playing hot potato with the lawyers, trying to, hold him hostage for money.
Ransom him, yeah.
It's the movie. Like, I'm so glad because the movie even deals with it. Like, the lawyer's like, you know, yeah. like this is and that's it. You know, and will Tom Cruise's Charlie, you know, come to grips with his brother? Will he be able to make accommodations for him? Will he be able to appreciate him as a human being, et cetera, et cetera? That's the emotional core of the rest of the movie, like him coming to grips with his own self, his relationship with his brother, his father, how he feels about that. And it features just a really good and interesting performances, like Tom Cruise is emotional powerhouse. Dustin Hoffman as like restrained and controlled you'll ever see an actor in a performance. And the other thing is, this movie's beautiful. Like, there mm-hmm. are some shot, the road trip sequences reminded me a lot of some of the stuff we saw in the Easy Rider, just sure. huge sweeping vistas of the American Southwest and Midwest, big skies in Montana, et cetera, sunsets over mountains, sunlight shafts piercing, you know, mm-hmm. through clouds, bathing. It's just really these shots that come pretty frequently are just gorgeous and kind of worth the price of admission all by itself. So that's Rain Man. All right, before we get into the spoilery stuff, let's take a quick break. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
No lunch this week, as I'll be traveling on vacation, but get ready for next week when we have the rare, elusive, dare I say premium lunch with Talitha and Aaron.
And while you're waiting for the return of the king, don't forget May is the time to switch your Patreon tiers to make sure you maintain your full benefits by June. Stop by support.baldmove.com to check your Patreon levels to see the new benefits and decide which one is right for you.
And finally, tickets are now on sale for Badass Fest 6. Come meet us live and in person, watch a mystery badass film with us, and then hear us record the podcast right there in front of you in a theater packed with Bald Move fans. Get your details and your tickets at baldmove.com/live.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com right now to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content plus ad-free feeds. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
All right, Jim, where do you want to start in our spoilery discussion of this movie?
Let's start in very, very smoggy LA. That was one of the things that shocked me, because LA isn't as smoggy anymore. But this was made in the late 80s. And that was before they had really dealt with that problem. And holy shit, that first shot of the LA skyline is depressing. It's crazy.
Absolutely. And the film leans into that, like the whole central kerfluffle is over these Lamborghinis failing their emission, the EPA tests. And there's even one line that I loved where he's like, the whole valley is covered in smog and they're wanting to run down four Italian sports cars. But like every scene,
that's the problem, dipshit.
You can barely see the city. You can barely see the mountains in the background because it's just like, good Lord, how did people live? That's like turn of the century England when they're burning, or London when they're burning coal and all the houses, just like this black fog everywhere. Like, God damn.
It's like parts of China turn of the decade.
Exactly. So I thought that was interesting how they weave that into the plot, and also just like really cool stuff, like the opening shot of this Lamborghini being sky craned from the, you know, the boat or whatever onto the dock. It like, it looks like something out of Blade Runner. First I'm thinking like, I don't remember Tom Cruise working on like movies, because I thought sure this was going to be some kind of movie shot of some kind of alien you know, spaceship or something landing, but no, it's just a Lamborghini
sports car. He's importing a lot of different kinds of Italian sports cars. They're all Italian, and that made me wonder, because when we get to his girlfriend, whose name I don't know in the movie, what is her name?
Susanna.
When we get to Susanna, she's clearly like an actual Italian actress. I'm wondering if like he is with her because he likes her, or he's with her because he's got the business importing Italian sports cars, and she is very useful for making those arrangements.
That's a damn good question. Did that actually, because I haven't seen this movie once, did that come up in their big fight, their big blowout fight in a hotel?
I don't remember it.
So this is mostly about his treatment of Raymond and extrapolating how he treats everyone, including her. But she didn't, because I was like, I wonder if she specifically said like, yeah, and you only wanted me because my uncle that works in the factory can get you the blah blah. Yeah,
she might have said something to that effect, but yeah, I mean, that would come in super handy, having someone who speaks Italian where you're importing Italian cars.
Yeah, any inn would probably help.
Yeah.
What do you think of the portrayal of Raymond as an autistic savant? So this is one of the big criticisms I've seen in this film is like, while it brought a lot of attention to autism, in fact, like, you know, 1988 is weirdly a year of inflection for autism awareness, like autism diagnosis and awareness like skyrocket after 1988. And a lot of people call it the Rain Man effect, because people, you know, before you just like, oh, kid's slow, or oh, just having a hard time getting along with people, or it seems, you know, blah, blah, blah. Now people actually had something to like pin on this diagnosis that it kind of demystified it. But one of the common criticisms is like most autistic people cannot memorize a phone book in a single night, or at least half.
Well, that's the savant part of it, right?
Like that's the savant part, right? Yeah.
You can have autistic without savant, and probably vice versa. I don't know.
I think that's one of the criticisms.
Specifically an autistic savant in this movie.
Yeah. One of the criticisms is like a lot of people just like it became like a stereotype that like, yes, people are aware of autism, but like they didn't get the fact that like, you know,
Yeah, I can
imagine that. That could be frustrating. I feel like 4 years later, that's no longer the case. But like early goings in the 90s and early aughts, of people were like, "Oh, you're good. So what do you go? Can you count cards?" Stuff like, I'm sure like any stereotype can be harmful. But as far as like, I thought that I don't know. I just thought it was a really interesting performance because they gave him a lot of strengths, like these like, I don't know, Herculean abilities to process like raw numbers and like counting things and memorization, feats of memorization, against like his inability to deal with like change in. And they did a lot of that. Like it's not just like, you know, schedule and routine, but like he didn't like to get wet. You know, he doesn't like to go out when it rains. You know, loud noises and stuff really trigger him, which I thought like when, you know, when they went to Vegas and were going to go count cards, I'm like, Jesus Christ, well, as soon as he steps into this floor, it's going to be like, but, you know, so sometimes it came and went conveniently to the script. But
yeah, and I don't know overall, what do you think realistic that is? I think the portrayal of that was amazing. I think the acting from Hoffman is incredible. I think the portrayal of, you know, autism in this character, Raymond, you mentioned like how he has incredible, you know, capabilities when it comes to crunching numbers and stuff. But he also has like some things around that are not nearly as incredible, right? Like they have this demonstration in a doctor's office somewhere in the Midwest. I don't know, where he goes in and he's like, "Hey, Raymond, what's 3,526 times 4,218? And he knows it off the top of his head. But then he asks him, like, if you bought a candy bar for a dollar, with a dollar, and it was a 50-cent candy bar, how much change would you get? And he has no way to process that. He doesn't understand these concepts around the numbers, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like, oh, he's got this superpower with numbers. Anything with numbers, he's great at. It's like there's a very specific way his brain works. And I think that was one of the more nuanced portrayals of it, is it'd be very easy to say, oh, he's just great with numbers, period. But they don't do that, right? They take it a little bit deeper.
Right.
And they do that throughout the movie. You know, it's not like the Vegas thing doesn't necessarily trigger him. I think that's like a positive for the movie because it is a lot of stimulation, but also it wasn't really the stimulation that was the problem for him. It was the very specific triggers, right? Of the rain, of like a loud noise or something, or of hot water in a bathtub, things like that. Those would trigger him. It's not necessarily, oh, there's just a lot going on, because he tunes out also, so much, right?
Oh yeah, and also like, you know, I think by the third act, because this Vegas stuff happens in the third act of the movie, that you're supposed to start thinking like, okay, you know, is Raymond going through some growth? And we see he does. Like, he's able to make a joke. He's able to, you know, withstand the onslaught of the Vegas stimulation and all that kind of stuff. So it's like he's growing, and that's the thing. It's like, through all these scenes, I was wondering, like, you know, how if you made Rain Man today, like how that Midwestern doctor office would go, because I thought it was pretty good. And you're left from that as thinking that like Tom Cruise is like kind of a butthole, and that's how you're supposed to think of him through most of the movie.
Oh yeah,
but like, you know, is like Raymond not really able to process like the meaning of money, or is he just never had a reason to?
Sure.
And he has a coping mechanism of when people ask him something that's kind of like out of his depth, he just rattles off something. Because it seems like also Raymond is very much like wanting to just kind of like what do or say anything that can get him back to something that's familiar, you know, and that about $100, you know, someone's asked me about a price. It's $100 is the price. I'll just throw it out there. Like with time and patience, could you actually teach him some of that stuff? Like, could you teach him how to make a joke and what's appropriate? Like, I think that the answer is like autistic people can learn just about anything,
for sure.
It's just you might have to think of different ways to teach a person that, you know.
It'll
you
take a lot longer. It could take a lot longer,
a lot more patience. It should be a struggle for them to retain. There's going to be a lot of the fate, but like, yeah. And I thought that was kind of cool too. But I was constantly wondering when we're like, you know, is this like a hard limitation of his, or is this something that?
Well, that's the great thing about this movie, especially in 1988, when people know so little about autism and don't even know really what it is, or understand that it's a thing that exists. you step into a movie theater, you see this movie, and you're along with Charlie for the ride, right? You have either no idea what autism is, or maybe you have some wrong ideas about it. And I don't want to say the movie's perfect, because I don't know like a ton about autism, but I will say, from what I do understand, it's pretty accurate for this mm-hmm. particular, you know, for a flavor of autism, right?
For this far on the spectrum with the savant, yeah.
Right. It does a pretty good job of portraying that. And I feel like as an audience member, you're sort of learning along the way too, right? Okay, what are Raymond's capabilities and limitations? How do I need to adjust my thinking about Raymond during the course of this movie? Mm-hmm. Just like Tom Cruise is doing, just like Charlie. That's one of the areas where the movie succeeds.
And I think it's part of it because, like, you know, Dustin Hoffman, pretty good actor, you know, subscribes to the method, does a lot of research. And apparently he followed around three autistic men. One of them was a Kim Peek. There's another that was like the brother of a famous in Major League Baseball player, and just kind of like spent 6 to 8 weeks following them around, living with them, like getting down like the different stimming practices, like, you know, how like sometimes Raymond would like slap his head when he's like overwhelmed, the different ticks, word ticks and stuff. So it's like it felt accurate, because I don't think Dustin Hoffman would just be like, oh, I'll just act like
I'm gonna wing it.
No. Yeah, I'm just gonna just act like whatever I think a person. No, he actually did a study and tried to humanize it, because I think that's the other thing is like that. The most painful thing is like there's like one point like Tom Cruise literally screams in his face, like, why can't you stop acting like a retard?
Yeah.
Which that's always like, because that's one of the things I think in our friend group, we kind of like unspoken was like, you're never going to say this about, like, you know, we're never going to, you know, like, because this is our friend. Mm-hmm. And it's such a. But like, I also know that like when I was talking about our friend with other people or some people, like I'd overhear conversations where some people have the opinion that like, well, OK, maybe he's got a problem or two, but they really play it up like, oh, he really knows how to turn on the impairment when he's blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that is such a really ignorant way to look at what's going on here. Yeah. But it's also like one of those things that's shocking. But like a lot of people, I think before movies like this kind of had that like, oh, he knows enough. If, you know, when he is really does or when she's doing this, well, and they can.
And that's one of the things that Tom Cruise is doing in this movie. Yeah. Is putting his own expectations for a normal person like himself onto Raymond. Right. And that is the mistake he makes throughout. What, 80% of this movie? I mean, it's only like the last, I wouldn't even say the last act. It's like the second half of the last act when Tom Cruise like turns around and starts to finally get Raymond. That Raymond, and it's exemplified by this scene where Dustin Hoffman, Raymond is repeating Who's on First, right? This mm-hmm. Abbott Costello sketch.
That's, yeah.
Classic. And Charlie comes up to him and he says, like, you're never going to. Why do you keep saying that? You're never going to solve this. It's a joke. It's not a riddle. It's you're not going to solve it. And in that moment, I'm looking at Charlie and I'm saying, why are you shouting at this autistic savant? You're never going to solve it. Right. This is not a riddle to be solved. This is a person that has some form of atypical neurology that you can't just shout at and get him to act quote unquote normal, right? That's not going to work.
Right.
Why don't you get that? Why do you keep running around this who's on first thing in your own head?
Right. Why are you the way you are?
Yeah.
But that's like ableism 101 that like, I think it's born out of people trying to analogize their own situations. Like, oh, I broke my leg. And I had to hobble around for 8 weeks, but I got over it. And like, also if I really wanted to get off and get the remote control, I could do. And they're trying to analyze, you know, like, yeah, I think it's like stems from kind of empathy and all, but also frustration with this, like, well, why can't the other person do that too? Like, well, I was sick when I was a kid for like 2-3 months getting over mono or something. So I know what it's like to be a kid in a cancer ward, you know, like it comes from a, you know, like that's what humans are pattern matching, you know, like, oh, this is a person with this thing and I had that thing. And also we try to be empathetic towards people, and that like all goes haywire when you're trying to deal with something that's so far outside of like the norm or so far outside of your personal experience, and you get things like
Yeah, Tom Cruise screaming in his face or doing like even like benign instances of like when Raymond had made, I forget what it was, maybe he was dancing with somebody and he like did a fairly successful human interaction and Tom Cruise's reaction to grab him into a bear hug. Yeah. And it's like, but which of course then, you know, set Raymond back significantly because that's invading his personal space and all that. He doesn't like to be touched and all that. But like, but also it's like that was one of the cool things about the movie, watching Tom Cruise figure out the accommodations he could make. Like, I'm going to buy this guy a watchman, a portable TV so he could always have his Wapner. I'm going to like get a hotel when it's rainy because like, it's just not worth, like, there's no way you can make this guy do something he doesn't want to do.
Right.
And this even like there's other just like I just thought there is I started noticing this throughout the movie. And I thought that Levinson put the stuff in, like there's a scene where they're waiting in a waiting room and there's this old man with probably middleway dementia just going on and on about the Pony Express to no one in particular, and like showing another like atypical, yeah, like someone who used to be quote unquote normal and now has kind of gone on to some kind of spectrum, and like the futility of trying to like screaming at old, and I've seen that happen too. I had a grandfather Alzheimer's. My family's not perfect. The frustration that comes across there, but like how ridiculous it would be. And also it's interesting that like Raymond interacted with this guy with zero frustration. Like he was just sitting there and like just listening to the guy go on, because he's perfectly happy to be droned on to about the Pony Express.
Yeah.
So like these profoundly impacted individuals were like simpatico in a way. It's just, there's a couple other situations like that where they kind of like waved to someone that had some, you know, you just kind of drove by somebody having some kind of like compulsion or whatever. And I thought that it was intentional to kind of like ask you, you know, what does it even mean to be impaired? And if we take it literally, like probably aren't we all impaired with something or another? And
that's why like movies in general can be so important, right? And specifically movies like this, because they give you a window into an experience that you don't have personally. And they can give you, you know, more compassionate, more empathy for people in those circumstances. You know, they can do a lot. I think movies are more important than just, and I'm not going to say all movies, like Fast Five probably didn't do any of that. I mean, I didn't learn anything from that other than you could. That's the safe one, right? Is that the one where they drag a safe around the street? I might try that.
Maybe that's Fast Four. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Skyscraper Jump. I can't remember. But yeah, I mean, movies can be important in that way, right? To expose you to things that you wouldn't have real life experience with and give you some way to relate to those people.
Right. I want to talk about some things that like with one viewing and not knowing that this was the case, like I caught on. Like when I was watching it with Cecily, you know, Raymond talked about how he had this childhood friend, the Rain Man. And then we meet Raymond like literally 3 seconds later. And I just, like I said, I wonder if there's some kind of, you know, relationship here. And then it kind of comes out of nowhere, this experience in the hotel with the hot water burn baby. Yeah. And like, I think like the script made a couple leaps ahead of where I was at, where like Tom Cruise like instantly intuited that like, oh, you were this kind of like comforting, soothing presence that I barely remember and I couldn't. Was that clear? I guess, was that clear to you? Or I felt like it was a little like murky. And also, yeah, Tom Cruise asked like in the I don't know, what do you call that? The family court session or the therapist session, that like they're trying to have a competency hearing or whatever, and it didn't go in his favor. He asked like this question of like, why didn't anyone ever tell me that I had a brother? I felt like there wasn't very good answers to that,
for sure.
Or maybe the answers lie towards the old man's problem he had with Tom Cruise or something. But like, I felt like maybe it'd be clear if I watched it more, but like I didn't quite understand how all those things connected, and like that seemed like a reasonable answer. Like, how the hell do you not know about this brother?
Yeah, I think you're right. It was a little bit muddy. They don't totally explain it. They just sort of let us figure it out while Tom Cruise is figuring it out. But he has like the script has this character with these lived experiences that we aren't as privy to, you know, that there's a right. life within that character that the audience doesn't get to quite see. But I think we see enough of it to understand that, okay, there was a relationship area one time. And, you know, there was an incident where maybe Raymond put Charlie into a bath that was too hot, trying to, you know, take care of him. And then that caused him to send him to Wellbrook, whatever the place is.
So that's the other missing piece of the puzzle. Like, was there an allegation that Raymond hurt Charlie, and because of that, the father like had to, you know, like, well, I can't allow this happen. I got to ship him off. But like,
I think so, but not intentionally. Right. It wasn't like Raymond tried to hurt.
No.
It happened.
But also like Tom Cruise came with the impression that not only did Charlie not try to hurt me, but like Charlie's trying to save me. Like that. There's a leap there. I didn't quite understand. And the other thing is like, it also wasn't clear to me, because like it all tracks that like, oh, well, if Tom Cruise became a selfish asshole, that the father would try to protect the brother from him. But like, if Tom Cruise is like 3 years old during the burning incident, then why wouldn't you have him be a part of Raymond's life going forward? Because Raymond's now an institution. He can't hurt Charlie, even if he wanted to. So like, that's the stuff. It's like nothing mm-hmm. quite connected those two incidents. And I wondered if it was even necessary to have this kind of like, you know, and it almost felt like it's exclusively like the two guys who wrote this, Morrow and Bass or Bass, like turn to the camera and be like, title Rain Man, huh? Like that's literally the only, because like Tom Cruise had already started coming all the way over to accommodating Raymond, seeing that he is a fully realized human that has like, he's different, but he's, you know, capable of affection and loyalty and all this other stuff. And like, it's almost like it's like if that was the thing that brought Tom Cruise over from like hating Raymond to like, oh, actually, he tried to save me. It didn't do that. So I'm like, I wondered why it was there at all.
Yeah, these little like half connected things and like sort of missteps in the script are the thing that keep me from saying this is a truly great movie. Yeah. Because I feel that about the way that Tom Cruise sort of turns around on Raymond too, like his feelings toward Raymond.
Really?
And that's part of it. Yeah, I think that like that scene, I'm getting glimpses of it. I'm getting hints as to what Charlie must be thinking, but also I'm not getting the full picture. I'm not feeling it like I should be by the end of this movie.
Yeah. No, there's something a couple structural pieces I felt missing, or maybe that stuff just needed to get out. Like I don't think it would have hurt to trim this movie 10 or 15 minutes. And if you got rid of some of that stuff, because it didn't really necessarily connect. What'd you feel about, how did you feel about Raymond's girlfriend? So was
Susanna.
Susanna. I was going to get it. Third time's a charm. Locking Raymond in a elevator, teach him how to dance and kissing him.
She doesn't understand what she's doing here. Is my opinion. Like, she doesn't know what kind of conditions Raymond has, really. Like, she hasn't been on this journey with them. And so I forgive her for sort of like pushing this a lot farther and faster than maybe she should have.
That's the one thing that I thought like is a legit cringe part of the movie, is that like, that's a hit my modern eyes of like, ooh, this is really taking some fucking liberties. And
at that point, you have to like rewind an hour of that movie and say, if Tom Cruise, like, look at how Tom Cruise was behaving an hour before this. And her approach to this is, you know, a more like feminine man, woman, like sexual approach to it, but it's not like. I don't know. It's a messy scene. It's a confusing, and I don't quite know how to talk about it, but it's, I forgive her for pushing this particular avenue of exploration for him, because she just doesn't know.
I think the movie, that, I guess that's the thing about it, the movie frames it as like a positive development. Like, oh, look at Raymond. He's dancing with the girl and getting his first kiss. Whereas like, I've like, I don't know. Cause like, you know, our real life friend, like that was one of the, as he got older and we all got older, that was like the most, one of the more painful things for him is that like, he has kind of like the mental and emotional awareness of like preteen, but the body and desires of a man, and that and also he's independent enough that he like, you know, had his own job and stuff. And sometimes that shit did not mix real well and caused a lot of difficult problems for people to solve. And that's what I was thinking this whole time, like, Jesus Christ, this is, you know, not, it's inappropriate. It's blah, blah, blah. But, you know, again, the movie is like, what, 34 years old at this point. And and everybody knew that. But like, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, when Tom Cruise left Raymond alone to like, you know, what was he trying to do? Cook for himself? Like I felt like even at the end of the movie, like Charlie had thought that like, oh, you know, maybe if I get him an apartment and I stuff it full of apple juice packets and, you know, things he likes to eat and like that, you know, and that's something that can happen. And it's just like, no, Raymond's got too much of an impairment. He need a lot of work and probably living with him to make that pull that off, which I'm, you know,
being in that institution is good for him because he needs that attention 24/7.
Yeah, I wish I knew more about his relationship with his father, because like obviously Raymond has some positive views of his father, and his father loosened up. Like, he was so ruthless with Tom Cruise using his car, but he lets Raymond drive it around. We saw how Raymond does driving around in a car park.
Yeah.
You know, curbing things left and right. Like, yeah, like what, like, you know, was that like a once a year kind of guilt trip visit for his dad, or was he like there every day? Or I had a lot of questions because obviously his dad's a man of means and was probably retired for a long time. Like, why wasn't Raymond living in the house?
A lot of questions around that, and they don't care to answer them.
Which is fine. Movie. Which is fine. It's just like this, some of the other stuff where it's like, again, the movie's old, not sure what it knew it's doing, what it was doing on accident, what it was like, and also seeing it the first time, like, you know, some of these things might be explained if you got another viewing or whatever, but, what else do you want to talk about? I do want to talk about this film's legacy and impact on, you know, mental and cognitive impairments. Do you have any other points that you wanted to talk about?
Oh, I mean, I have a lot of just observations about like the humor, because you mentioned like the humor is really good in this movie. It's a funny movie at times, and I totally agree. There are a few scenes like when they're leaving one of the towns in the Midwest, Cincinnati, they're leaving Cincinnati, and Raymond's like, oh, I'm definitely not wearing my underwear. We got to go back to Kmart. I'm not wearing my underwear.
Right.
Hilarious scene.
And that's where he pulls over and he like walks like they have a crane shot, and Tom Cruise like walks half a football field away and just starts screaming, son of a bitch, son of a, just out of sheer frustration with his brother wanting to go back to Cincinnati for Kmart underwear.
Yeah. And then he throws his underwear on the road. He throws it out of the car and Raymond says something about it. I don't know. Like, oh, you threw your underwear on the highway. And then there are a couple of other funny scenes, like he finally learns Tom Cruise can be taught. Aha, congratulations. He finally learns not to let Raymond out of his sight after like the fifth time that he turns his back and Raymond's gone.
Then it's gone. Yeah.
Right. He takes him into the phone booth with him and he's trying to make all these calls, and Raymond's got this backpack and like, it's a very cramped space and he's talking about how cramped it is. And at one point he just says, uh-oh, fart. And it's apparently a pretty bad one too.
That's like Charlie. A really, really good physical comedy from Hoffman, because just the way they're moving in his booth, like, you know, like Tom Cruise is trying to talk on a phone, and also every time he turns to face Raymond's back on the other side trying for the door. It was just, it was like I said, really good physical comedy, and Hoffman plays it. Hoffman is able to be that funny, and he never breaks character. He never like turns things up or whatever. Like, these are just this is just like what would happen if you try to put Raymond in a glass box.
Yeah.
He's a
straight
minutes.
Man, right? In the moments of comedy, he's the
ultimate.
I don't know which is the straight man, Costello or Abbott, but he's a straight man in that duo.
Yeah. That's also like, that's one of the geniuses of the smart things in a script, I should say.
is like, you know, having him, his home base, quote unquote, be the Abbott and Costello skit, like, mm-hmm. you know, fame stare and crazy man, like in Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman both having that kind of energy. Yeah, because like Tom Cruise is a pretty good ranter. Uh-huh. He's a pretty good, like, losing his shit, you know, whether he's jumping up and down on Oprah's couch or he's screaming into the desert about his brother's fixation on underwear. He gives. And that's another one of the Tom Cruise's gifts is he's very good at playing these literally cocky, selfish, mm-hmm. ruthless assholes. But he's still so fucking likable that the audience never quite turns on him. Right. Yeah.
And like when he does have his turn, you follow him down that road.
Yeah.
You forgive him for everything that came before.
A lot like Leo, I guess it's just attractive people.
Yeah.
You know, charismatic, right. attractive people. Turns out, get away with a lot. That's true. But yeah. It's a strength because he does, like, yeah, if this was like, you know, like Steve Buscemi, like, I feel like the audience turns on Steve Buscemi somewhere in the middle of the second act. Like the second he screams the R word right in Dustin Hoffman's face, it's like, okay, yeah, fuck this guy. But, you know, you're always kind of like rooting for the guy with the weird car business and the hot girlfriend. And, you know, it seems attractive and if he could just, you know, learn to care about other people.
Mm-hmm.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
All right, before we get to sort of wrapping this thing up with the bigger topics, one more thing. This movie was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Score. Did you have your volume on while you were watching this movie?
I was not aware of the... I mean, it's got a couple of, like, kind of doo-wop numbers throughout?
No, it's like... this movie is a two-hour Toto music video. Like... I just kept saying, I kept feeling like they were going to say, I felt the rains down in Africa every time the main, like, pan flute theme would come on. I hated the music in this. I hated it.
It might be of its time, though. You know, like, I mean, wonder maybe. If there's going to be, like, 30 years from now, some of the stuff that Trent Reznor's doing, the industrial synthwave stuff, is going to be like, Jesus Christ, I get it with the droning bass. Like, you know, it's like, it's ever going to be kind of like that. I it's so generic I didn't even notice it.
Wow. It was the only thing I could hear when it was on the screen. I don't know why they chose that musical style either, because there's nothing in this movie that says anything about, like, you know, vaguely Caribbean, like, nothing in this movie fits that music.
That's like Commando. I watched that 6 months ago, and I think he's got a full Calypso band going. Right. There's a dude on the beach smoking a doobie, playing a steel drum behind everything. And I'm like, what the fuck is this?
This is like one step removed.
Yeah, like one guy wears a Hawaiian shirt in his movie, and they're like, I got it, steel drums for everything. Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't get it.
Like, L.A.? I mean, I guess they must have shown a palm tree at some point, but that doesn't mean Caribbean.
Yeah, but I don't know. Like, man, that was wild. That aesthetic, that like woodwind, like you said, Toto. Yeah. Phil Collins fucked around with that a lot. Like, didn't Peter Gabriel do some of that stuff too? Like that was kind of in the. Yeah. But yeah, winning an Oscar for it. Okay.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I hated it. Okay. I'm ready to talk about better stuff than the music.
Okay. Let's talk about, cause that's one of the things I was really curious about. Like what, you know, how was this viewed contemporaneously by the autism community, which kind of didn't exist. By people, and how is it viewed today? Because, you know, that's something that I've seen a lot. Whenever a particular group gains visibility and acceptance, they go through this kind of like well-defined pattern where you have like unflattering portrayals that kind of like get the door wedged in, and like stereotypical portrayals, but allows like a group of people in the door. Then you have token, where it's like they're just cast to be the whatever minority X in something, and they're just essentially treated like everybody else except for they got the one thing. Like they're a guy, it's a guy in a wheelchair. Just nothing about that and that's important to the plot. It's just one of the plucky groups of friends is in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
And then you have like the roles where it's about the thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you have these like very sympathetic, and it's like, you know, a 2-hour movie about a person struggling with the wheelchair and how they got in a wheelchair, how they feel about being in a wheelchair, how society perceives them and how that affects them. And for the first time, you're like, oh, again, you kind of. And then you have like what you call like normalization, where it's like you can now, it's no longer token because people bake all that other stuff. So when the plucky friend is in a wheelchair, you remember all the times you've seen the intense wheelchair biopics, and you kind of like take all that knowledge, and now that guy can be anything. So Rain Man, as the first kind of autistic and first kind of like starring role for a person that has a different, you know, way to, you know, view the world cognitively, emotionally, stuff like that. It's definitely going to have things that hit our ears wrong 35 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I found a lot of stuff. Like I said, like 1988 is widely seen as an inflection year, that the rates of like diagnosis and awareness of autism just like skyrocket. That's a huge increase in diagnoses and resources being aware and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of people attribute that to Rain Man, which is positive. As we've already said, that there's also some stereotyping that like people thought that like, autistic people. Okay. You got to watch Wapner and you got to have your particular underwear. But hey, you can also memorize a phone book, which mm-hmm. probably is not great for people that are not autistic savants to have that kind of like stereotype out there. But I mean, on the whole, like I feel like a lot of people, because the people involved did have their heart in the right place, were telling authentic people's stories. The people involved in production, the stars were like did their homework and research. It still, I think, holds up, and it feels like that's the consensus with a couple of modern critiques. Like, for example, one of the biggest critiques I saw is like why we have Dustin Hoffman play this role instead of a person with autism, you know, kind of like the way RJ Mitt, is it Mitty? And Breaking Bad plays a person with the cerebral palsy, some kind of motor dysfunction. He is not nearly as impaired,
right,
but he
right.
does have that impairment, and he brings that to the role, a certain amount of kind of humanism and dignity to it, you know, like someone with that condition is representing it.
I don't think you can literally have someone as you know, you put it deep into the spectrum as Raymond is perform on film. I think there are a lot of questions about consent on that. There are a lot of questions about like, how do you get this person to perform the way you want them to? That would be tough. I think, yeah, maybe you could have someone with a little bit less severe autism come in and play that, but certainly you weren't going to get that in 1988.
But it's interesting because like 1989, smash hit TV show Life Goes On, starring role of Corky, played by man with Down syndrome, not as severely impaired as what he was, but like that already, I don't think that show happens without Rain Man. Much less like, you know, the. So like you already see even back then Hollywood starting to take, you know, some of these critiques to heart. And I it's like, so a lot of times people ask me this, it's like, what's the whole deal? Like, why do you have to be like, you know, why does it matter that like you have an Italian guy playing a Mexican? Why does it matter that you have someone from China playing a Japanese person? Why does it matter if you have a person who's straight and cis play a trans woman? Isn't that what acting's all about? And I think that that's actually true in a perfect world, in a world where like a person with a disability has an equal shot of being a good actor as like a Chris Hemsworth.
Mm-hmm.
Or a Dustin Hoffman or Tom Cruise or whoever, in a world where like, you know, especially like, you know, Mexican and Indian Native American actors in the 50s and 60s had an equal shot of portraying their own people as like an Italian actor or a person just with wearing bronzer, for example. Mm-hmm. Like if we lived in a world where that was all kind of equal and fair, then yeah, go nuts. Dustin Hoffman want to play an autistic man. But we don't live in that world. We live in that world where those roles are very vanishingly small. Like, think about all the dwarf yeah. roles you've seen that are serious and how many of them are Peter Dinklage. Like, there's right. tons. And for every Peter Dinklage, how many Peter Dinklages we got that don't see the light of day? Because there's Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
And I think it's like, I'm not going to go back and like burn Rain Man's prints to the ground because what they did in 88. But like,
no.
I think if you made this in 2021, you would want to find someone with some kind of autism that has an insight that, you know, obviously, because, yeah, there's all kinds of like, would it even be humane? Like if you got someone as disabled as Walt Jr. is on Breaking Bad, would they be able to stand up to a full shooting
right.
script? Could you make accommodations? But also, could you make yeah. accommodations so you could get that authenticity? I don't know. I just think like a lot of people just don't get past that first hurdle of like, well, what's the big deal? It's acting. Which is true, but, you know, like you got to think about the entirety of fairness and like an able-bodied person taking a disabled role. It's already hard enough to break it into Hollywood when you're disabled. You know, that's, I think that's what sticks in people's craw. But yeah, in 88, going back and trying to recast that, you know, that's the thing is like, you know, if you buy all this like autism inflection point at face value too, it seems like maybe there weren't as many autism people that knew they were autistic back then.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Especially people with a mild version of it, right? Like,
yeah.
Maybe they just avoid eye contact or something, or maybe, you know, like they don't quite know, oh, yeah, I've got autism. They just think, oh, that person's a little weird.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and a lot of the other criticisms I see is like, you know, the way that Tom Cruise initially treats the guy as, you know, as a MacGuffin is pretty beyond the pale. But like, even contemporaneously,
I
think you're supposed to understand. Yeah, yeah.
You need a journey, right? You can't have a journey without starting a journey to a good person without starting with a bad person. Like,
and just like, you know, in Philadelphia, you know, if it were uncomfortable with the way people treated mentally ill people in the late 80s. Well, there was an uncomfortable time, and we're still, mm-hmm. you know, like there's been a lot. I'm not going to say there's not been a lot of progress, because I knew that the kind of yeah. the ways people were portrayed on television and movies back in the day, and I know how they're portrayed now. And there's been a lot of progress, but still needs. But yeah, like, yeah, sometimes that's uncomfortable to watch because it was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything that I've seen, like Tom Cruise say to Raymond, to Dustin Hoffman here, I've definitely seen said to the people I care about and about them. So it's like it seemed like it was a pretty good performance. But yeah, I mean, like, as a long story short, things have changed a lot in the last 30 years. And if you're autistic, there's probably, you know, I could see there being valid criticisms, or if you care about people that are autistic, that's stuff that doesn't quite strike you as themes stereotypical nowadays. But all in all, it seemed like it was good for its time, and it still holds up. Because at the end of the movie, I didn't think that Raymond. And that's the other thing that felt like one of the reasons it felt melancholy and uncomfortable is like, because I wanted, you know, like you said, it wasn't possible for Tom Cruise to care for Dustin Hoffman, but like you wanted something more. You wanted, because you saw how much growth and how much that relationship meant to these two guys, and you wanted that to go forward. The movie gives you a little bit of hope, but I don't know, like that. There's something about the way Tom Cruise, after he says goodbye to Raymond, he just kind of sits there and the movie ends, that makes you think that, like, you know,
did this week approximately really change Charlie that much? Or is he going to start thinking about like, yeah, well, what am I? I'm going to try to get these testosterones over here next. And I got to patch things up with my girl. And I got to, you know, the one guy that I've been berating for the first half of the movie, I haven't even talked to him in a week. And is he going to get too busy in his life?
Or I wonder if they've heard of Raymond, of Rain Man over in Atlantic City. Right. Like you wonder right. about that too.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole card counting business. Yeah. It's one casino band. I don't know. We'll see. They essentially do the MIT tour. When Vegas is too big, yeah. Go to Atlanta City. When Atlantic City tried to reservations once have you, the shady places in the Bahamas, and you just kind of go around and around.
Oh, that was the other thing. There were two moments in this movie that made me go, holy shit, the 80s were crazy. Or the 80s were just different. That's that smog scene at the beginning, and then it's the shot of the skyline in Las Vegas, where I stayed in Caesar's Palace, not in the fancy high rollers room, but
Yeah,
the strip is completely different now. Completely.
Yeah. Like that was we've been talking about this before, like the transition era where they go from like the old strip to the new strip. Like you could see like the Caesar's Palace was there, like the start of the new strip. But like a lot of even the stuff that's like dated nowadays, like Luxor, I don't think was there.
Like
right?
Sands. I think Sands was still up. I don't know that Sands is still around. The Mirage is like right next to Caesar's Palace.
Yeah, and like it's changed again because like a lot of films like in the early 2000s showed the old strip as being this run down, shitty kind of like afterthought, yeah. which it kind of was. But now they turned it into its own attraction, man. They've covered the street. They've shut it down to like you just can stagger from casino to casino. There's like what they call the sky lines, zip lines. There's zip lines run up and down and like high def LED displays. And
oh
like,
yeah, there's so, like overhead trains that run around. There's a big ass Ferris wheel. Yeah, it's
always interesting. Like you see stuff from the 50s and 60s versus the 70s, 80s versus the 90s. Like it's yeah. Vegas is always changing, man.
It is.
Vegas. I'm actually hoping to go there later this year, making my trumpet nice. Return back. Since the last BIPAX, but I think that'll do it for our Rain Man coverage. Hope you guys have enjoyed it. It's a great film. Check it out. I think it holds up, but also doesn't hurt to view it more critically with a modern eye. We'll be back with another prestige film or perhaps a television series. Hopefully coming back pretty soon. We're waiting for some prestige television to drop.
Yeah,
I'm not looking for the 200,000 a week viewers on HBO, but like it'd be nice if we had a Better Call Saul, for example, come back. Mm-hmm. Something to sink our teeth into week
we
to
missed
week,
for but, all mankind, unfortunately. But
but then would that be pulp because it has rockets
no.
in it?
No,
yeah, I
don't
agree.
Think so. But we did cover it on Off the Clock, so if you're a club member or patron, you can check that out there.
It would be funny because like I think it's entirely possible that it will cross the threshold into pulp. Within the next season or two, but you know, it'd be first ever crossover pulp prestige hit. But they'll have some stuff out for us eventually. And if not, we'll continue making our way through these classic movies. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.